Hello, and welcome to the Panzer Podcast. My name is John Burgess, and I will be your host today as we deep dive into all things tanks. Quote, the 75 is firing, the 37 is firing, but is traversed around the wrong way. The Browning is jammed. I was saying, driver, advance, on the A set, and the driver, who can't hear me, is reversing. And as I look over the top of the turret and see 12 enemy tanks just 50 yards away, someone hands me a cheese sandwich. End quote. This little tidbit, as recounted by the late Keith Douglas, who, during the middle of fighting, remembered his dear friend Ken Giles and his illuminating story of what it was like fighting within the main character of our current story, the medium tank M3. His was, however, an M3 Grant, to be specific, the British version. It's a small quote from a fantastic book, Alamein to Zemzem, which was written by the man Keith Douglas. Well, he was KIA on D-Day plus 3. He was killed by a mortar round while he was dismounted doing some foot patrol style reconnaissance. This book, coupled with David Render's Tank Action and Stuart Hill's By Tank into Normandy, are quite the combination and excellent reads. They tell the stories of three men, who were actually all part of the same armored unit, the Sherwood Rangers, Yeomanry, which has a long and storied past harkening all the way back to the 18th century as a cavalry unit. By 1942, the regiment had been fully converted into an armored regiment, rocking and rolling with the M3s and even some early M4s during the 8th Army's foray into North Africa, which ultimately would lead to the defeat of Rommel and his famed Africa Corps. Of the three books, Keith's is the only one which details the unit's time in North Africa, mainly because Keith was the only one in North Africa, who was ultimately in Normandy with the other two blokes, however, not for very long. Some of these excerpts about the M3, which, if you weren't already aware, is our topic of discussion today. I do wish to say that this episode will only be an edging type experience. We are going to lay some groundwork for what I anticipate to be a 3, or more than likely a 4-part mini-series within the Sherman series, detailing the life and times of the medium tank M3 and some of her variants. The reason for this somewhat shorter episodes falls into two parts. First, I have been swamped at work. And I did take a vacation 2 weeks ago to visit family up north in San Francisco with Miss Panzer Podcast. And while it was a fantastic trip, bang bang Niners gang, I did not have as many opportunities as I thought I might have to, you know, have sit down, do a little research, finish reading a couple of books, and do some writing. I know the big joke is that everybody packs a dozen pairs of underwear for a 3-day vacation. And I do that too. But really, for me, it's books. I always pack way too many books. For some reason, I envision my vacations like I'll be sitting someplace, yucking it up with a cool, refreshing beverage and my favorite book about tanks. A man can dream. Secondly, and this is probably my eagerness to get on to the Sherman, and also my short-sightedness in not realizing that the M3 is a, you know, direct line relative and predecessor to the M4. And, well, duh, John, we are going to need a proper rundown of the M3 if we're ever going to explore the M4. Because, you know, we would like to understand it from top to bottom, inside and out. Right? Right. So with that in mind, please bear with me. This is not an announcement episode, which I know we all love those. The analytics don't lie. But it may not be the short bridge into the M4. Instead, we are going to set this motherfucker up, and then we'll break for the holidays so that I can ensure I do this vehicle and my wonderful audience the proper amount of justice that this vehicle deserves and knock it right out of the park. So let's dive in. If you'll recall from the previous episode, on August 15th, 1940, the order for 1,000 M2A1 medium tanks had been contracted out to Chrysler, and subsequently, 13 days later, it was canceled on the 28th of August. It was replaced by a contract for 1,000 M3 medium tanks. Well, how is that possible? The same reports which came in during the early spring months of 1940 indicated to everyone who was paying attention that thin armor and a tiny gun wasn't going to cut it on the battlefield. The German snub-nosed 75mm cannon, which was on the Panzer IV, was turning out to be a bit of a problem for Allied efforts against it, and essentially everyone agreed. A weapon that was at least as powerful as the German 75 was not just wanted, it was needed, and needed badly. If you'll allow me to wind that tape back just a little bit, I know, it's an old trope at this point, but we don't have to go back that far this time. So instead of August of 1940, we're going to time travel to June 13th, 1940. OCM 15889. Just a refresher. OCM, which I am going to use a lot, means Ordnance Committee Minutes, or notes, just the meeting notes. Anyway, the M3's characteristics were born in this June 13th brief. Well, sort of. OCM 15889 really only details the requirements of a new vehicle, not so much the how, which, as one might imagine, is rather important when engineering something so complex as an armored fighting vehicle, which, 1 month later, on July 11th, 1940, this new vehicle had already been standardized as the medium tank M3. I mean, even the Germans did a little more proofing than that with the Panther tank, so what gives? What's that old proverb or the old adage, necessity is the mother of all inventions? I believe you can attribute that to one of those deep-thinking Greeks or Romans. I can't remember which, and for what it is worth, really doesn't matter. The point is, the world was in a bit of a tight spot, so without much hesitation, production plans were put into motion, even before the final drawings had been finished. Remember, France had already fallen, Dunkirk had trapped the bulk of British armor on the beaches of northern France, and by all accounts, the miraculous rescue of the British Expeditionary Force by civilians and the Royal Navy alike most likely saved the Allied war effort. You can at me later if you like, but that's a pretty decent take on the whole matter. At the same time, the Brits were in serious need of some armor if they were going to continue prosecuting the war against Nazi Germany. Which, you know, Britain was doing this relatively alone at this point, I might add. You know, the Battle of Britain and the Blitz was just beginning in July. Essentially, something had to be done, and the United States, with or without a proper declaration of war, was going to get involved. Even if by clandestine materiel aid only. This flash in the pan was nearly a perfect storm. Though the M3 would not be as nice to look at as, say, George Clooney navigating off of the Atlantic to his doom. The new vehicle would equip both the burgeoning American armored forces as well as re-equip their Anglo cousins across the pond to help vanquish Hitler and his thugs before this whole thing got proper and out of hand. Spoiler alert, it gets out of hand. Not for a lack of trying, but even with the Detroit auto industry hanging massive dong, it still required some time to transform this whole thing into the juggernaut it would be by the war's end. With this in mind, the British wasted no time in sending over their very own British tank mission, led by a Mr. Michael Dewar, whose initial plan was to convince the top brass in Washington to mass-produce British tanks for the British Army so that they could fight Jerry on their own terms. Well, not so fast, Mr. Britain. The US of A doesn't like being told what to do. Okay, that's not exactly what happened. What really matters, however, is that when negotiations began, the Ordnance Department and those who had control over the purse strings of the US War Department simply were not impressed with British designs. Sorry, UK listeners, but the US were not keen on producing Crusaders and what have you. Not to mention, some of the designs, say the Cromwell, which was designed in 1942, wasn't mission capable until 1944. A story for another time, perhaps, though this was only one side of the no coin. The other side was simply that the US did not wish to waste potential resources by retooling manufacturing and ultimately producing two or more simultaneous projects. Again, mass production was not really a thing in Great Britain at the time, so this line of reasoning kind of made some sense. Why waste time and resources to produce two separate lines of armor when you could simply combine the resources and produce a lot more of a single type of vehicle? Makes some sense, right? Right. Though, some compromise would be made, because the British were sort of, I don't know, up against the wall. Their country was not ready to produce all the ships, guns, planes, bullets, artillery, tanks, and everything else that they were in desperate need of for the war. Though the Americans were willing to compromise, Honeycutt puts it quite succinctly. Quote, "The British mission was informed that only designs acceptable to the U.S. Army would be produced. However, some modifications would be permitted on the equipment manufactured under British contracts. On this basis, the British placed orders for the M3 with a modified fighting compartment and a new turret." End quote. Not quite as harsh as a take-it-or-leave-it type deal, but it was the best the Brits were going to get. And that's how the cookie, the biscuit crumbles. British contracts would be fulfilled by various US companies, initially an order of 685 M3 tanks, were placed with the Baldwin Locomotive Works with an additional order of 1,000 tanks split amongst the Pullman Standard Manufacturing Company and the Pressed Steel Car Company. There was an additional order of 100 tanks, which was contracted out to the Lima Locomotive Company. Though the order would not be filled as a delay in production would later change this order, instead of the M3 over to the M4. And if you're wondering, yes, Lima Locomotive is located, or was located, in Lima, Ohio. The same town in which the Joint Systems Manufacturing Center is located, which are the very same folks who produce the M1 Abrams and all of her variants. Though they are not directly the same company, the JSMC is actually the direct successor of the Ohio Steel Foundry Company, which operated the site before being bought by the U.S. government as part of the U.S. Army Tank Automotive Command, TACOM's, expansion. The JSMC plant, known during the war as simply the Lima Army Tank Plant, Ohio, which would actually end up producing the M5 light tank and even some of the early T-26 versions, which are the prototypes to the M-26 Pershing tank. It is still, I don't know, kind of a little interesting tidbit to think that historically, Lima is pretty damned important for the history and success of the U.S. Armored Force. Though that will be something we'll have to touch on a little bit later. Because right now, we're still stuck in 1940 and trying to figure out how to get the British and American armies their new medium tanks. Alright, Enough dilly-dallying. How the hell did the army come up with the M3 in such a short expanse of time? Was it magic? No. Was it? No, okay, stop it already. The reason the M3 was designed so quickly was because, in a lot of ways, it had already been kind of, sort of, designed. Or, I guess, prototyped. All the way back in April of 1939, the T-5E2, which was one of the latter T-5 prototypes, which had not been standardized. Remember, the T-5 Phase 1 became the M2 Medium, which then became the M2A1, and so on. The T-5E2 was the T-5 testbed, which had been equipped with the M1A1 75mm pack howitzer, which was mounted on the right-hand sponson, replacing one of the rotor turret-mounted Browning 30 caliber machine guns. Finally, one of the extra prototypes which had been used for further testing is, at least in our narrative, handing out dividends. And how? So, the original design of the M3, which was encouraged by the summer heat of 1940, and probably most likely just the war, was to plus up the M2A1 by both increasing the thickness of the armor and equipping her with a 75mm cannon. This would be done by installing the cannon into the same right-handed sponson as the T5E2's howitzer. Simple as. So, a short-barreled 75mm cannon was installed in another rotor-style turret, or mantlet. This offered the gun a little more traversability than that of the 75mm howitzer. This new cannon, and I only say new because it was new to the armored forces. But in reality, this 75mm, known as the T6, was initially envisioned as some kind of low-velocity anti-aircraft gun, which, even as I read the words aloud, sounds fucking insane. And stupid. Obviously, knowing just a little bit about aircraft, low-velocity cannons aren't really effective at swatting them out of the skies. But as a tank weapon, well, hey now. That 75mm T6, now rechristened as the T7 cannon, was going to work out just fine as a tank gun in 1940. Speaking of which, the very early, and I should use the word prototype here very lightly, since this vehicle was absolutely rushed to the production floor, but this early version sounds better. The early version of the medium tank M3 made every concerted effort to retain any and all machine guns from the M2A1, which could amount to 7 or 9, depending on the anti-aircraft arrangement. Dual front-facing fixed 30 cals? Check. 4 rotor-turreted 30 cals? Nope. We now have a 75mm T7 cannon displacing this machine gun. So only 3 were in the barbet or fighting compartment section of the M3. The turret of the M3 was still sporting the M3 37mm cannon of the M2A1, along with the coaxial mounted 30 caliber machine gun. So we have 6 instead of 7 for this basic arrangement. Well, everyone, that simply would not stand. This aggression will not stand. And so, still being obsessed with machine guns as ever, the United States decided to develop an additional cupola, which, for all intents and purposes, is a cute little tiny turret that sits atop the cupola and, of course, has a 30 caliber machine gun mounted within. Ah, balance. Last but not least, to improve survivability and increase the likelihood of not getting destroyed when enemy contact happens, the armor was increased to 2 whole inches, or about 51mm thick, on the front-facing portions of the vehicle, which included the hull front, the turret front, sides, and rear. The sides and rear of the fighting compartment and the hull were expanded a little bit to about 1.5 inches, or 38mm thick. this was deemed rather acceptable. And if we stop the clock and look at the other comparable tanks at the time, we see that the German Panzer III, the Offs D through G, had about an inch and a quarter, or 30 millimeters worth of armor, all around. The floors and the roofs were a little bit thinner, but we're just kind of glancing at this vehicle. The Panzer III H model, which would show up later in 1940, and more of them would show up in early 1941, had an additional face-hardened plate of 3/4 inch, or 20 millimeters, in additional armor. Meaning, you know, if you add in this, you know, the front armor plus this face-hardened plate, it had about the same armor as the M3 medium. The earlier model, the 1940 model, of the Soviet T-34 tank, had only a 1 3/4 inches, or 45 millimeters, thick hull front and sides. While the turret could be up to 2 inches thick, or about 51 millimeters thick, and this kind of varied by production plant, we'll have to get into Soviet stuff later, not to mention that the T-34 was strutting around in sloped armor. Not to say that the M3 didn't have angles of her own, they were just more harsh and different than the sloped armor of the T-34, something we'll dive into later. Suffice it to say, the medium tank M3 that the Americans and British had come up with was, at least on paper, holding its own amongst the modern contemporaries of the time in 1940. Quote, "The major weakness in the design was the limited traverse of the hull-mounted 75mm. End quote. All right, that's fair. The rotor turret only allowed for a 15-degree traverse in either direction, meaning the field of fire was only 30 degrees from left to right. The elevation of the cannon was plus 20 and minus 9 degrees, which used geared wheels to move the turret about. So why not just put the 75mm cannon into the turret and be done with it?" Quote, "The Ordnance Department pointed out that no turret had yet been designed in this country to carry such a powerful weapon with full 360 traverse. On the other hand, many of the design problems in the sponson mount had already been worked out with the pack howitzer and the T5E2. End quote. Thank you, Mr. Honeycutt. I really don't know what we do without you. So there you have it. It was simply the devil that the armored force knew, and instead of designing something that they had never tried before, they had a full-blown working sponson turret device, already kink-free, no shame, and ready for production, which is exactly what the doctor, or in this case, the beleaguered British Army, called for. The armored force wasn't as convinced. They urged the army to produce a more limited run of the M3, maybe 6,000 or so, you know, see how it goes kind of thing, pending what they assumed would be a 75mm turret design forthcoming. Well, again, the Brits really fucking needed some medium tanks for their operations in the Middle East and elsewhere. So they binned that idea faster than you can say, Bob's your uncle. Instead, full production would continue as agreed upon. The Americans were also not blind to their own requirement of some military parity with the current belligerents, probably seeing that it wouldn't be too long before the U.S. was sending tanks somewhere to fight someone. To appease the armored force, while production would go forward without delay, a new tank would simultaneously be designed using the same basic chassis as the M3. However, this new vehicle should be equipped with a larger 75mm gun and a turret mount rather than a hull-mounted cannon. The idea was, even at this early stage, to transform the production lines from the current M2A1 to the M3 to what would ultimately become, spoiler alert, the M4 Sherman, without, hopefully, skipping too many beats. We discussed in the previous episode how You know, this is exactly why the U.S. auto industry was able to successfully propel mass production from the drawing room floor to incredible excesses and feats of production without a whole lot of effort. Well, a whole lot of additional effort. With all of these grand plans having been laid out during that August meeting in 1940, some semi-final revisions were hastily put together and subsequently approved by OCM 16111 to include all Sponson guns were to be eliminated. So bye-bye to the three remaining rotor-turreted 30 cal machine guns. They would instead be supplanted by pistol ports to cover the sides and rear of the vehicle. The radio set would be moved to the left-hand sponson near the front, opposite the 75mm cannon. Fuel capacity was now also increased to a whopping 175 gallons, or 662 liters. Additionally, the turret compartment floor was actually lowered a little bit to give more headspace to the crew within. You know, the guys fighting in the turret. And the new and improved, read, comfortable, seats with, surprisingly, they actually had safety belts as a standard feature. Who knew? Finally, periscopes for the crew. Holy shit, we have finally arrived. Periscopes instead of direct vision ports. I mean, the driver still had a direct vision port to the front, but he was also afforded a pistol port slash vision device to his left. And finally, satisfied with these changes, a wooden mock-up was created, shown to the boys with a ooh and an ah. The medium tank M3 was created. Or was it? I really should stop doing that. We discussed above that when the Brits pulled up with all of their soon-to-be outright rejected models, they struck a gentleman's agreement with the Americans that they would be allowed to design their very own and quite British turret. So one Mr. L. E. Carr, who, according to Bruce Alexander Blue in his 2010 thesis, The Ram Cruiser Tank, An Ambitious Failure, was notably a, quote, mechanization board tank design expert, end quote. So our mechanization board tank design expert, Mr. Carr, had actually come along with the British tank mission, led by Mr. Dewar. And after detailing the recent British experience in fighting German and Italian tanks, the most obvious flaw in the American version of the medium tank M3, to later be known as the M3 Lee, as to differentiate the models, was that the silhouette was just too damned high. I'll quote from Blue's thesis again. Quote, the most obvious changes was a slight lowering of the tank's silhouette by the removal of a cupola-mounted machine gun and the relocation of the radios to a redesigned and enlarged turret, where the tank commander would have full control of them. End quote. The American M3 Lee's height, measured from the ground to just above the cupola, was 10.25 feet, or a smidge over 3 meters tall, whilst the British version, by eliminating this machine gun cupola, was lowered to 9.9 feet, or nearly exactly 3 meters tall. If we broke it down to inches, to be more precise, and why not? That's 123 inches down to 119 inches, or 312 centimeters down to 302 centimeters. Not a lot of difference, but there you have it. The silhouette was technically lowered. And everyone knows, the best kind of correct is technically correct. This new turret's cupola, instead of being one of the machine gun variety, had a rotating split hatch cover with a periscope mounted within one of these half-moon hatches. The British designed their version of the M3, known as the Grant 1, or simply the M3 Grant, because, and I couldn't help but include Honeycutt's touch of comedy here, as to why the British decided upon calling theirs the Grant when the Americans chose Lee. Quote, "It was obvious which one the British considered the winner." End quote. I fucking love it. Throw that shade. With the basics laid out, a wooden mock-up, or termite food, the Brits and Americans were ready for the tremendously arduous and detailed task of the actual design that would be used to produce a tank in an actual factory. Quote, "Close coordination was required between the design team at Aberdeen and the manufacturers to allow the earliest possible start of production. Preliminary drawings were issued to permit the purchase of raw materials and the necessary machine tools." End quote. This back and forth and close cooperation between the design firms, the production plants, and the Aberdeen folks was impeccable and outstanding. Designers at Aberdeen helped guide the automotive manufacturers in creating the most simplified yet robust parts that would ensure mass production could be carried out at the massive scales yet to be seen on the planet. The summer and fall months saw a flurry of action getting everything prepared for the M3's production in every sense of the word. While detailed drawings were created, while Aberdeen was tinkering, Rock Island Armory was simultaneously constructing the pilot tank using these preliminary drawings. This was moving fast. Using these early molds, a turret was able to be cast, sent to Aberdeen, fitted with the 37mm cannon and all of the rotation accoutrement. It was installed on an M2 medium chassis for demonstration to the tank committee all by December 20th of 1940. All the while, at the exact same time, the British turret was also quickly cast using some more of these prelim drawings, and again, fitted to another M2 for demo. By Christmas, the actual production drawings were about 90% complete. So that means, if you're counting, in about 4 months, we go from the M2A1 being the U.S. medium tank to now having two. And I know saying two models is a little disingenuous, but whatever. There were now two models of the M3 about ready for production in only 4 months. I want to say impressive, but we'll have to reserve judgment because we should all be well aware, especially as Panzer Podcast listeners, that rushing things like armored vehicles can and will have consequences, unforeseen or otherwise. As 1940 comes to a close, production targets, which were initially set to 14.5 M3 medium tanks produced per day, 8 M3 Lees for the Americans, and 6.5, I don't know how you get half a tank, of the M3 Grants would be produced for the British. However, this kind of split production wasn't going to last very long. It was clear that instead of operating as two separate buyers and contracts for the tanks, a combined effort would make the most sense, both from a planning and production side of things. Early in 1941, the US and British formed the Joint Tank Planning Committee. And I know we're kind of jumping just a little bit ahead, but this part, it just needs to be said. So in early 41, the US and the British Joint Tank Planning Committee, this was done to overhaul the production planning for both nations moving forward. It would not take long. By April of 1941, in fact, this committee had decided to push for 1,000 M3 tanks produced per month. And by July of 41, they had decided on 2,000 M3 medium tanks per month. War was serious business, and after some formal meetings between Churchill, FDR, and some bloke named Lord Beaverbrook, the final production targets were laid out as such. 25,000 medium tanks should be produced by 1942. By 1943, that target was 45,000 medium tanks. That's a lot of tanks, and they were setting these targets in the summer of 1941. Granted, you know, but this is jumping ahead a little bit, but it behooves me to remind you listeners that by the summer of 1941, cough, June 22nd, 1941, Hitler had full-blown committed to invading the Soviet Union, and it was not looking great, which might be telling as to why the Prime Minister and the President at the time were keen to get production turned on and rightly keyed up to meet the demands of this ongoing conflict. Okay, so to get back to where we were, all of this, you know, all of this is all running parallel. It's all in rapid succession. It's running all at the same time. So I apologize, but we need to return back to February 1st of 1941, which is where we will set our scene. The initial design plans were finished for the Pilot M3 vehicle, which was completed and, you know, by March 13th, 1941, was moving under her own power. A quick note on these Pilot vehicles, which is to say the Pilot or lead vehicle is essentially the example of what a finished model ought to look like. These would be sent by each of the manufacturers to ensure that standardization, interoperability, interchangeability, and for overall quality control. These Pilot vehicles would then be sent to Aberdeen for further proofing to double check that all of the manufacturers were staying well within their allotted tolerances. This is something that in a lot of ways, at least at the time, was unique. In 1941, very much so. And it was almost unique just to the Americans. Every U.S. tank could be parted out and fitted onto any other U.S. tank, regardless of manufacturer. This is because all of the tolerances and quality controls were quite stringent. Not to mention all of the pre-planning and the simplification done prior to the assembly line made this effort a forlorn conclusion. Mass production, folks, was the American way. And with that, the first Pilot tanks from Chrysler arrived in April of 41, and the first from Detroit by May of 41. The game was afoot. And that, sports fans, is where we're going to have to leave off. Now, I am not doing this to torture any of you. That would be cruel. I, too, wish to continue rambling on for hours and get through our little M3 detour and get back to the M4 Sherman. I know we can all taste it, but like I said previously, the M3 is going to get the full Panzer podcast treatment, which of course means diverging the story a little bit into the M3 Lee camp and the M3 Grant camp. We'll have to save the deep dive into the characteristics and the sweet, sweet details of turret ring diameters, ground clearance, and all of that minutia until we return from the holidays. I figured we ought not to rush this, as that is not the way of this show, nor do I really want to miss anything. I've acquired some books on the new subject as well, so I'm eager to tear through those. Thank you to everyone who ordered some stickers. Those proceeds went towards basically all these books. And after which, of course, after which I mean reading, I should have a more complete story of the M3, which will provide that final link in our chain to that which we so desire, our M4 medium tank. And before we head down the rabbit hole of M3 and all of her variants, I need to inform you that I will probably only have enough time to release one, maybe two episodes before the end of the year. After this episode, of course. I haven't decided if it'll be a one-off, a fun story, or maybe a reading of a personal account. We'll cross that bridge when we get there. It will probably be shorter since, you know, I've got a holiday trip planned coming up and won't be able to do much in the way of recording. Just know that I am essentially in research overdrive to ensure that the M3 gets the full Monty. One last thing. Speaking of what I'm tentatively calling the Christmas episode for now, and this is mainly because I appreciate all of you and your support, I will be sneaking in some sort of coupon or whatever to the Panzer Shop in the next episode. so keep your ear to the ground. And remember, the Panzer shop is located at thepanzerpodcast.bigcartel.com. And once again, I do wish to apologize for missing last week's deadline. I just recently got a new computer all set up, but forgot to get my recording studio set up with it. So anyway, we're all good, and yeah. As always, I can be reached via email at thepanzerpodcast@gmail.com, on Twitter at thepanzerpod, and on Instagram at thepanzerpodcast. If you like what we're doing here, I would appreciate a positive review on Apple Podcast or Spotify or however you're listening, if possible, because it does help us reach new audience members, and I super appreciate it. Until next time, I'm John Burgess. Thanks for listening.